think mine was going to give us up to it.
I'll add some variety, I think. Because we're a bit, short of time, I'll just try and cut to the chase, and what I'll go through is just what we are. Go through a couple of slides explaining what the problems are with the current distinction between liabilities and equity, and then take a step back and think about what we're trying to achieve with the distinction before we dive into what the discussion paper talks about and what the preliminary views of the board are. Slide two just tries to illustrate the relatively simplified way what the problem with the current distinction is. And slide two is it's really a picture of what the standards level problems are. Putting it simply, existing IFRS, they don't apply the classification of debt and equity consistently. For example, IFRS 2 would classify most options to issue shares as equity, whereas IAS 32, it's a bit different depending on the specific characteristics of the instrument. Some of them might end up as debt, some of them might end up with equity, and you get similar types of instruments ending up in one classification or the other. And slide three illustrates the second order problem, which is once an instrument is classified as equity, there's really limited information that the financial statements provide users about the effect of those different classes of equity on each other, the differences in the payoffs, transfers of wealth and dilution. You do get some information from EPS, although that's kind of has its own limitations. You don't really see the effect on the return on equity because of the differences or the inconsistencies of the classification. And this is compounded with the lack of disclosure. So once something is an equity instrument, then IFRS 7 doesn't apply. IFRS 7 applies only to financial liabilities, not equity instruments. So the question is really, what information do you need if there is more than one class of equity? And if we step back and look at what it is we're trying to achieve with the distinction that's on slide four, the distinction is trying to do two things. Because the effect of the classification is twofold. One effect is the balance sheet effect, and that is trying to show you the liquidity and solvency, so the cash obligations to the non-cash type of obligations. And the other effect is the dilution of return, so differences in the payoffs between different claims on the assets of the entity. And some instruments do both of the above. A simple debt instrument will have an asymmetric payoff and, you know, be an obligation to issue cash. However, there are some instruments that affect one and not the other. So you could have some instruments which are, for example, redeemable shares, which whereas they might require some kind of cash outflow in the future, they won't have a dilution effect on other holders of equity. So I think some of the problems at the standards level are really caused by this tension between trying to meet these two objectives. And I think the board in the past has prioritized one over the other in some cases, which has led to the inconsistencies. So what the discussion paper tries to do is, or explore, is how we different ways of achieving both of these objectives. And slide five just there's a brief summary of the outcome of those two approaches. We call one the strict obligation approach and one the narrow equity approach. And as you can see, for the strict obligation approach, which is based on on the existence of an obligation to pay cash or transfer some kind of asset of the entity. It classifies the liabilities based on that, the existence of that characteristic. The consequence of that is you probably get more than one type of equity instrument. And in order to address the secondary objective, which is the dilution of return, the discussion paper talks about providing more information in the statement of changes in equity to show users the effect of these different equity instruments on each other. On the other hand, the narrow equity approach classifies instruments based on the most residual or the most subordinate claim on the assets. And by doing that, it's going to be showing a lot more information within profit or loss about the dilution effect of more senior claims on assets. So everything else, including stock options, minority interest perhaps, all those changes would be going through profit or loss. However, the problem would be with this type of approach is that the balance sheet would not be showing investors what kind of instruments would, or the amount of instruments with a cash obligation on the entity. So additional disclosure would be required to communicate that information, because you won't be able to see it on the balance sheet. Slide 6 just does a brief comparison. I mentioned a lot of these already. As you can see, the strict obligation approach, you can see that the cash leverage on the balance sheet, whereas the narrow equity approach, the cash leverage will have to be reported through some sort of disclosure.
So, sorry, Manuel, can you clarify can you clarify how you define cash leverage, and then why in the narrow equity approach it has to be provided by disclosure? Because if I look on page 5, I still have the different components on the face of the balance sheet, right?
That's right, and I think for number 5, it's just the case of whether you have a subtotal or a total within that balance sheet to give you that. Of course, you know, you can add up whichever ones you think are important to denote the cash leverage. And by cash leverage, we're talking about obligations to transfer cash or other assets. However, we define assets as not including the entity's own equity, which causes some of the problem.
Liabilities, going back to our prior discussion, would be including what we would call financial and operating liabilities.
Yes.
Why is the minority interest is in the one in the strict obligation, the other in the narrow equity? I think you probably there's also you can also look at it isolate that from strict obligation and narrow equity, because now you're trying to combine various topics in only two models. I think.
Can I clarify that? If you classify the obligation, it might be measured differently than if it's classified as equity, or is that not one of the reasons?
That's one of the issues with the current requirements, because whereas for a liability you'd have to be measuring that from a period to period basis at the moment, for an equity instrument, there's no requirement to subsequently measure that. And if we go further down the track, I was going to show you how we would propose to remeasure some of the equity instruments as well in order to alleviate that. And then it becomes a question really of if we're providing you the information regardless of the classification, where would you be drawing the line in that case?
Could you explain, because one of the things that I've had a problem with for a while is on slide 6, you say that the strict obligation approach is more consistent with the conceptual framework. This is a conceptual framework conversation, so I'm not sure that's relevant. question sort of is,
Tertiary.
Well, it is, and I've been accused of saying backfill and I shouldn't, but I don't want to use it here. Although it seems to apply. Could you explain what you mean by more consistent with the existing framework? Because I thought the framework was sort of silent on this issue. So,
because I think the strict obligation approach is really anchored on the definition of a liability. Whereas I think the narrow equity approach might require a...
So what's the definition of a liability other than a bad thing? But that's the only one that I've ever found that actually works, so I apologize for being so simplistic, but it's the only one that I know that works.
Well, all of these are basically claims on the entity's assets. The liability at the moment is defined as an obligation to transfer an asset of the entity to the holder of that claim. So the strict obligation approach would apply, which is why we call it the strict obligation approach, is because it would apply that definition strictly. And if there does exist an obligation to transfer cash or other assets of the entity, then it would be classified as a liability.
I think to get to where you are, you've assumed the definition of what equity is, and you've defined. I think implicitly you've defined equity as being the residual of
yes.
what's not assets.
Yes.
And if you define equity just for a second as the current shareholders, just define for a second as the current shareholders, not shareholders, the current shareholders, all of a sudden options become a claim against the current shareholders, and they become a liability. So,
well, that's the narrow.
That's the narrow
approach.
But yeah. that it is the narrow approach. But what I'm challenging is more consistent with the current framework. And I'm saying if you define equity the way I just did, which is equity is the current equity holders, the strict obligation approach just converged with the narrow equity approach, I think. And so that's why I'm exploring sort of why these are so different from a conceptual point of view. I think it's because you've made some assumptions in here that are different.
The problem I have with the strict obligation versus the narrow equity, and I think maybe if you put this in a bank balance sheet context, is that strict obligation seems to me, because it pushes the bright line sort of roughly to the middle, it creates all sorts of opportunities for flipping one side or the other. Whereas if you have the bright line far to the right or the left, whichever way you want to think of it, so that you're basically just saying it's the common stockholders right now, that's a very, very narrow group of people. And then everything else is some sort of prior claim or... That seems to me to be a safer way to define the bright line, because if games happen, whether it's subordinated or convertible or whatever, it's still something other than equity, and I will see it somewhere else in the balance sheet in the sort of order of priority. That's my concern with strict versus.
Would you still want to know which obligations, which of those claims would be a cash claim or a...
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to have lots and lots of information about all of those different claims. I want to know who sits in front of whom. I want to know what the nature of the claim is, when it can be exercised, whether it's secured or not secured. I want decisions about whether it should be revalued each time or not, and all of that stuff. But I'm perfectly happy to have lots of different rules for all those different things to be worked out, or some principles. But just in terms of the sort of the gameplay opportunities and a nice conceptually simple starting point, I think the narrow equity is a better place to begin. And I think it ties in more clearly with what quite a lot of different user groups have fed back on, which is that the sort of starting focus should be from current common stockholders.
And would you want profit or loss to be defined that way as well as changes
yeah.
in all of those?
Well, yeah, let's forget about that, but I would want to see as one of my sort of subtotals, one of my sort of performance sort of measures, I would want to see what's left for common stockholders after everybody else has taken their slice.
I think it's worth re-emphasizing what is really necessary is the waterfall. And it's also important to understand the waterfall is scenario-based. So it depends on... think of options. Think of the strike price of all. You're going to have. There are a whole bunch of these things. There's sub debt. Remember that in some highly leveraged, in some workout situations, the sub debt actually starts acting like the equity. So this is highly scenario based, and you can imagine some series at some prices where a bunch of convertible debt just is out of the picture. So it's not just a single waterfall. It may actually look like a branched waterfall, and we need all of that information. And I'm trying to explain why we need it. What's happening is we talk of the single user, but in fact, all of us are different. That's why I asked Jed before, which one are you when you're thinking that answer? Because if you're at the top and you're the bank debt holding secure accounts, you have a very different view than if you are the sub debt and you have some question about how much is going to be left over for you.
I think we're starting from the wrong place, because you're falling into the same issue that all accountants and standard setters and lawyers do, which is start from a liquidation basis of business. If things go tits up...
Well, you
did to an extent, because you were talking about the sub-debt, and you keep moving around what your perspective is, and it seems to me if you're producing accounts on the basis that a business is going concern into perpetuity, what we're all caring about is who participates in the upside without any upward limit of any description. So if you sold the parent company, the holding entity whose shares are quoted on the exchange and is producing the accounts, who participates? And so my view of where we are is actually, I think you need three categories. I think you do need to get a strict obligation approach. I think you need liabilities. I think you do need a class of equity that's minority interests. And I think the P&L needs to go down to net income. Then you get an allocation to the minority interests, and everything else goes to equity, to the equity of the person who's producing the accounts. And within them, I would include the stock options. And then within the comprehensive OCI, again, I'd want to see the OCI related to the minority interests separated from the OCI related to the common equity. So I can see opening to closing common equity comprehensive income.
Because then
that's something that's rational to me. So as a shareholder, I want to look at what's the reconciliation between my opening and closing book values. The reason why I think you need to leave the stock options in there is because I don't think the movements on those in a year or in a periodic basis are that meaningful, because the outcomes are a continuum of lots of different scenarios. And so in this day and age of Excel and PDFs and graphics, why can't we just say, produce a chart which on one axis has market value, sale for of the equity along one axis, and on the other axis, which is payback to that instrument, and the common equity will go up, and you'll get a kink when one option comes into the money, and then it carries on up again, and then the convertible converts, and so the equity kinks down a little bit slower because you've now got some convertible coming in. And I can say, right, I think that we're going to sell this business for $1.5 billion. I thought the common equity was the only thing participating, and I was going to get 100%, but actually there's all these management stock options and things that are all going to vest, and I'm only going to get 85% of the proceeds. And that would be quite helpful information.
That's the word.
That's absolutely.
And the argument for narrow equity is because of the gaming. Because what happens is you've sort of got these classes, and you've got a red box and you can move things in and out of that red box. And so there is only really one, and you actually did it correctly. There are two places that make sense for the red box, and Mark may not agree with me. It's basically anything that sort of looks like equity is in the red box, or the thinnest little thing that is always equity, which is the current common shareholders. Then there's an informational issue. Under the current reporting, we have if you use the larger red box, we do not have enough information between transfers between people in that box, and you're going to have another statement. Yeah. Automatically.
But so the other reason why I think you need to leave that into all of those instruments in there is because as soon as you start putting some of those, that equity number is the balancing number. Everybody recognises that shareholders' equity is a meaningless number unless you're a bank, probably, or somebody else where...
Park that for a second, because I want to...
So getting that reconciliation is inherently sort of interesting, but the movements between the stock options and common stock at today's number is a sort of happens to be a random piece of noise on the 31st of December. And in order to be able to value that call option, you're relying on, well, it helps if the company's listed, but you're relying that the share price is the price that you're actually interested in on that day, which you're not. If you're a buyer, if you're an owner of the business, you're still an owner of the business, what it was on the 31st of December is irrelevant, and you presume you own it because you think there's upside.
Sorry, can I just interrupt us? For our district obligation approach, we are proposing that to deal with that issue, we remeasure the elements of equity. So we remeasure the options and we show the changes to the statement of changes in equity, and that's in slide 8.
Look at slide 8 and study that and see if it addresses your issue while we hear from Saichi, who's the patient.
Thank you. I have two proposals here. The first proposal is to divide the left side of the balance sheet into three: liabilities, hybrid, and equity. So hybrid includes call options, stock options, and minus the interest, and equity is equity. In this way, when you calculate the return on equity, you use equity. When you calculate the leverages, you use a hybrid plus equity. But this, I think, will show makes a more clear cost structure to the balance sheet. And the alternative to this is that maybe the larger equity section and maybe the clear subsection, equity and others. My second proposal is that to divide equity section in a narrow equity approach into three. What is three? It's the capital, retained earnings, accumulated other comprehensive income, plus minus reserves or provisions as required by local legal systems. Currently, the ISB, IFRS do not touch upon the breakdown of the equity. I think this is a major weakness of the IFRS. Because of this weakness, there's a confusion about the net income and recycling. And to me, the capital, retained earnings, and AOCI is pretty much different. Capital is something that we have paid in, fixed. Retained earnings we have already earned, realized, fixed. The AOCI, accumulated OCI, is something that seems to belong to me as of the balance sheet date, but subject to the rather severe fluctuation there. So these are three pretty much different things in nature. So therefore, I think to bring this into the equity section, into the three, breakdowns. The reason the IASB haven't done that is because the equity requirements are different country to country. But I think to make this broad three breakdowns and allows to add some sub breakdowns of the provisions and the reserves according to the legal requirements. I think that wouldn't cause any problem for anybody.
So, you should ask a question. You said that you divide the balance sheet into three categories. What would your income statement look like? Would you have the middle category there where you had the hybrids? Would the changes in those be going through the income statement, or how would you deal with those in some other way?
Well, that depends upon how you define the hybridness of these instruments. And I think there could be the various ways. For example, options may be reflected the P&L, while the minority interest, if there is some value changes, then reflect into the transaction with the equity section, and explained by the statement of changes of equity.
In slide 8, we try and illustrate some proposed enhancements to the statement of changes in equity, and as we mentioned, one of the shortcomings of the strict obligation approach is that you get those multiple classes of equity. And the discussion paper proposes to remeasure the different classes of equity to show how those transfers would occur, or the wealth would transfer, and what the difference is in the payoffs and the waterfall is. So we are trying to show you that information, but we're doing it through the statement of changes in equity.
I think the key thing that is missing here is that generally we are not so interested in the book equity amounts. We are interested in the dilution effect on shares outstanding. And I really miss here the effect. This is a whole lot of numbers for which none of them will be an input in my model, in my valuation model. I'm interested in the dilution effect. And for example, if there's a convertible bond, how much of the debt will evaporate because of the conversion? How much cash will the company get on the shares issued? Because shares are on shares issued following options. So I want to have the cash and debt impact and not so much the equity impact. So the focus of this statement is totally wrong in my opinion. I think that getting the waterfall is the basis to provide those other elements as well.
But I think that's an important point there, because we've not touched in this discussion what kind of disclosures there might be, and clearly there's a need to think about the disclosures, which has been beyond the scope of this section of the DP. But I think that concern about whether this information is relevant or not touches on Robert's point about the possibility of gaming, because your concern was you might get different outcomes depending on whether things were in the red box or the blue box.
That's one of my concerns. The other...
If I can just finish on that, one point about this statement is that concern should become less because there are subtotals here that can give you the same information regardless of whether it had been in the red box or the blue box.
So
if you'd gone with the narrow equity approach, you'd have everything in the blue box, you'd have the value changes going there through P&L, most likely through P&L. So if it had been on one side of the line or the other, depending on the exact terms of the instrument, it would either be in P&L or it would be in the subtotals in here. And Martin would still be equally uninterested in that particular number, regardless of whether that had been going through P&L or going through the change in equity. You'd still want all the waterfall disclosures anyway.
So if you say at a very high level, I'm going to give you all the information you need in a separate statement, do I really care whether it's the income statement or another statement? I don't. But when I look at this, I go, okay, and I'm echoing this, it's all here, but it's not, I don't think this is the format. This is going to require a lot of work for me to sort of figure out what is, because I'm really actually interested in EPS impact. I think there are two things. I'm looking at what was the cash output, and then what was the EPS impact. And this almost seems like an issue about, there's also a conversation about what should be in the P&L. And I think what you're saying is that these changes shouldn't be in the P&L, and I'm going, I'm not as fussed about what's in the P&L as I think you are. Because it's almost as if you're trying to get to a sort of a traditional P&L, and you want all these hybrids to be off the P&L because you don't think they belong in the P&L.
But then you're concerned about the distinction between liabilities and equity in the balance sheets.
I think that there's a lot of instruments that are gray, and I would have the way I see a balance sheet is sort of the short-term debt at the top, shareholders' equity at the current shareholders' equity at the bottom, and then minority interest is in there. It's sort of I really think of it as that way.
You probably rank them by seniority rather than more or less than more than 1 year.
I'm gaining about how you'd move it. I'm a little sensitive of a comment about you said about I'm always thinking about liquidation.
Not my last comment. You mean the earlier.
The liquidation comment. I often use liquidation as a way of testing whether things are right. I agree that we're, you know, in a going concern, we are talking about going concern. We're not talking about liquidation. But liquidation helps you to understand what the risks and the, you know, the variability and the risks that you're facing.
Absolutely.
And that's why I keep coming back to it.
Can I ask the same question in a different way? Because at the moment you don't get any information on the equity instruments if they're classified as equity. You don't get the measurement. You get some limited information through EPS. I think that, you know, the enhancements to the statement of changes in equity will give you that information if you want. That's going to be on the balance sheet as well. Perhaps they're not going to be, irrespective of whether we go down a narrow equity approach or the strict obligation approach, you're going to get a measure of these instruments. Do you think that would be worth it? Would you want to see these types of instruments remeasured one way or the other? Because at the moment you're not getting these types of measurements. For instance, the only way you see it is through dilution of EPS.
I keep coming back to waterfall. If you're trying to do the waterfall and something's changed, they need to be remeasured. You've got to remeasure them all the time. Whether you do it, whether you provide it or not, we've got to remeasure these things. In fact, part of the analysis that you do is actually to take the financial statements and make an assumption about what's going to happen in the future and how would you remeasure.
I'm definitely in favor of the narrow equity approach, because from a valuation perspective, this more complicated way of trying to establish first an enterprise value and then deducting the items that hasn't affected the enterprise value, I think the narrow equity approach definitely fits. I mean, to have the possibility, particularly if I can receive a market value of minority interest, that of course would be helpful. This is not probably the market value of minority interest, it's the ordinary minority interest, but at least I don't think it is apart from this respect in equity. Now, employee stock options, of course, the cost is included in operating earnings, in EBIT, so I have already included that in my valuation of the enterprise value. So I would not deduct the liability that refers to the employee stock options. But then going to written call options, well, probably the revaluation of it is included outside the EBIT, so that would be considered kind of a financial liability that I would deduct from the enterprise value, and then going up, those are the ordinary items. So when I do these deductions, I'm of course very interested in as close to a market value as possible.
Can you explain the example on
Jay?
Because I'm slightly concerned that, like Martin was saying, that it's not really giving us what we want. So,
okay. So we have on the 17th of February. So after the 1st of February, on the 17th of February, there's a written option that's been issued. For instance, it could have been issued in exchange for employee services or for cash, and the value of that at that time was 5,000.
The Black-Scholes fair value.
Yes. Yeah. So let's just assume it's fair value measured. So it's a market measure. On 31st of December, you remeasure that option. So the value of that option has changed to 4,000. So there's been a transfer of value because of changes in the value of the entity or.
So what we're saying there is we promised our executives 5,000 of value, and they worked really hard for over the year. Unfortunately, they were too stupid to add any value to the company, so the options have gone down. We got some free work from them. Therefore, as shareholders, we're
saying... Option values always decline, don't they? Because you've got the time value of the option. So even if the share price
let's put that to one side. Yeah. I don't know whether you were building that into your model. We've got a falling value of the option, which means that in theory we shareholders have sort of got something for free, so we're ostensibly slightly better off.
Well, not for free, but the wealth has transferred. That 5,000
We got work from the workers that we didn't have to pay.
But you're now 1,000 better off because of what's happened subsequent to that event.
I just wanted to be an employee share option. But, it's a straightforward call option.
Yeah.
Okay. So somebody got something they thought was worth 5,000, it's now worth 4,000, so we in theory are 1,000 better off. And then the next year.
And the next year, the same thing happens, so it gets revalued to 3,000, so the value just before the share option is exercised is 3,000. So you get another transfer of value between the existing shareholders and the holders of the option. The option is exercised. The exercise price is I think 7,000 here. So you get an additional share capital of 10,000, which was the fair value of the share option just before it was exercised, plus the cash that you received. So share capital is increased by 10,000, and the obligation to issue shares is extinguished.
So what I'm struggling with is walking into this meeting, I would have said I prefer the narrow equity. Is that something I always felt it was. Given our current framework, that was the thing that was going to get us closest to what we need, closest to the waterfall. I walk in with an open mind saying, okay, if you guys really want to use the strict obligation methodology, I've got some risks, I'm not sure I'm going to get the information, but where's my benefit? So you're proposing this because you think there's some benefit. What is that benefit to us as users that we wouldn't get on the... Where's the meat?
Well, if we were to go down the narrow equity approach, this obligation to issue shares would be a liability, and you would be revalued, and these changes of 1,000 each year wouldn't be going through the statement of changes in equity; they'll be going through profit or loss.
And it might be going through OCR.
But neither of those are offensive.
Yeah.
Neither of those are offensive. So. If that's the best argument you've got, why are you adding? You're proposing this because you honestly believe there's some benefit. You wouldn't be bothering. You wouldn't be doing the work.
At the moment, you don't get any of this information. No. So at the moment, you don't see these transfers. The share option is issued for 5,000. It sits there subsequently, and eventually gets exercised or it expires, and you don't see how that affects the existing shareholders.
Yeah, to give another example, if you've got a cash settled employee share option, that gets remeasured every period through P&L. If you've got a share settled share option, there's no remeasurement.
But if you went for the strict, is it the strict? Sorry, it's the narrow. Isn't
if
it?
You went for the narrow,
if
then
the narrow,
both
you'd get remeasurement with both, and it wouldn't matter whether it was cash or share settled, or indeed whether there was a choice, which would actually simplify that particular little bit of accounting in some respect.
But then with the narrow equity, you wouldn't get, you'd have to draw the line some other way on what obligations would require cash. So you'd have to get information about solvency or liquidity some other way.
But another point about this example, if you're in the narrow equity approach, on day one you issue this option. So if it's narrow equity, it's going to be classified as a liability, your equity is going to go down by 5,000. Even though no cash is ever going to leave this company. Example. It's either exercised and we're going to get some more cash in, yes, more shares issued, but more cash coming in, or it's going to expire and number of shares unchanged, but again, no cash outflow. So you have a dip in equity during the life of the option, then it comes back out again, which is, you might think, is a strange example, a strange outcome as well.
If I'm an existing shareholder, I've given up part of let's assume that the 5,000 stays 5,000. I think it's let's leave the measurement.
Yeah.
I've basically given up future cash. So I may have gotten good value for it, but I just that's exactly what's happened. My equity, the future cash flows to me just went down, and that so that seems to be the right answer.
I think my objection to this schedule is more or less it's predominantly that it's focusing on the book equity instead of all the other. If there's a change in book equity, there are changes in other bits of the balance sheet. and we don't see those. Whereas those are interesting. Those we will use in our model. The book equity is not really a thing that we model. We model cash, we model debt, we model the other bits, we model shares outstanding. And so this, so my problem is not so much with narrow or broad. My problem is that it's giving not the right information, or it's really incomplete. So if you look, for example, I also think that just starting off with the definition by leading the discussion is narrow or broad, I think it's much more constructive to focus on individual examples. How do you treat these? Because now we first need to, are we broad or are we narrow? And it's much more difficult to go through the discussion, whereas if you come up with a single example, it makes it much more easy. And I think start, for example, a convertible bond, just a plain convertible bond that will convert into equity. How does that? How would you report on it on narrow, and how would you report on the other? I mean, that's what I can relate to. But to me, after this whole presentation, it's still not clear. And it's look at them side by side. I think it's a very difficult way to discuss it. Non-controlling interest. Just look at non-controlling interest. What does it mean in the other one, and what does it mean in the first one? It's ask how we want to treat it. I think non-controlling interest should only relate to common equity claim, and not to preferred equity claim, not to have, and you can convert preferred equity into common equity. So if you have preferred equity of 100 million, you can say there's a 30% common equity element in that. That can be the case, but it's a very difficult way to go through the discussion on the way it is presented, to be honest. It's everybody starts with that.
I think that's a good suggestion, but probably not one that can be remedied at the moment. Carlos, and then Peter, and then we need to really wrap this one.
I'm not sure if I like the way you end up accounting for the value of stock options in the P&L, but I guess that was the best way people found to account for it. So let's consider it as the best way. The practical problem that we have with options is that it's very hard. You know the numbers, right? You know how many options a company has issued. You know the stock price. Right? You can do a simple calculation, which is just add the number of shares that will be issued from options to your current number of shares. But then you have a problem because, you know, there is a probabilistic assumption that, you know, those options will be exercised or not. So what the Black-Scholes tries to do is actually put a number to it, right? And that's the 5,000 number here. So in some way you could say if you believe the Black-Scholes is the best estimate of that cost for shareholders, that's exactly how much you should, you know, shareholders should add to your estimate of market value. That 5,000. So what you're saying is that, you know, over a year, you know, you look at the same thing as in the Fed, that 5,000 is 3,000. So, you know, your best estimate, now you know it's not 5,000.
You're going to be less diluted.
You'll be less diluted.
Yeah.
So that's
so the common equivalents have decreased. So I mean, I think about it by changing my share count by basically being the common shares in issue plus the common equivalent of the options outstanding. And then that's how I calculate my EPS number.
But if you believe, my point is that if you believe that this is the best estimate,
yeah,
this is not a bad idea. Right. It's the best estimate that you have, you know, about the cost of future stock options.
Yeah. And it gives you a number that you can divide by the current share price to work out
Common equivalent. But you know, the problem is that you rely on stock on Black-Scholes or whatever method to calculate fair value. I guess everybody
but already still, I think that is a better, more useful number than
what we achieve if we are trying to calculate the dilution thing. I mean, to me, this is a great achievement, regardless if whether it's liability or I can have the market value included in equity. Definitely, I'm interested in that because that is the number they want to deduct from the enterprise value. But if you take the example with the convertible bond, would it be like this, that you have a bond part that would be like an interest-bearing debt or bond, and then you would have the exercise, the option part of the bond include also as a liability in that case, the value to whatever model you'd like to value?
It's a good question. Unfortunately, it was beyond the scope of the
discussion
that we talk about compounds.
Yeah.
But we'll be thinking about
would be
that.
Even better.
It's exactly the same thing, it's just a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
I guess.
I find it how interesting.
I mean, maybe the schedule that's presented, would the investors find it helpful that a common smokescreen that investors have to deal with these days are companies that engage in share buybacks to offset options dilution. And then increasingly, because of the cost of options, they're issuing restricted stock instead. Is this a schedule that you think would help you see this cost that is quite difficult to decipher under present disclosure better, or is this headed in the right direction?
I need to see a more comprehensive example that would work out whether it would give.
You probably will want to see the conversation. You'll probably want to see part as a total compensation package. I mean, I think corporate bond, a convertible bond is a more neutral example than relating it to compensation. Because then you hook something into stewardship and people want to know, but is this the place to report compensation? I mean, I don't think so. This is not the place to report compensation. This is something different. It's about the insight.
You ask best to get that.
Yeah, just to be clear, the compensation would be reported here, not the sort of service element of it. That would be reported in P&O in the same way.
Yeah, we'd have had debit fee and L credit of 5,000.
Yes.
So we change our conception.
And a couple of extra fees beyond that.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Right.
Thank you.
I hope that was helpful. We'll close the public session at this point. I do think there are lots of just in public session, though. Thank the various members that are hitting their retirement dates from the committee. There's a few here today that are hitting that in terms of Jed, you're hitting it, and Shane, you're hitting your retirement. Further on hitting my retirement. It's been a pleasure working with all of you and Taichi as well. So I want to miss you out as well. So thank you, and thank all of you for the many years of good conversation.
And on behalf of the IASB, I want to echo that thank you, because I clearly understand, having sat in your seats for a long time, that this is not your day job. And there's really little in this for you other than to know that you are helping the capital markets and in that way helping society at large. And so I want to thank you all for generously giving of your time, and we really appreciate it. And thank you.
I'd like to make a general comment, not about thanking everyone for this, before we go to closed session, and I do appreciate it as well. I just wanted to say that because we've had a lot of, I know this is a discussion paper on the conceptual framework that we've been talking about today, but there seems to be a lot of thought and sometimes disagreement with our proposals. So I think if you can, it would be really helpful for us if you could write some kind of comment letter on the conceptual paper for the areas that you feel strongly about, because we need to make sure we get that in there now. Why we're talking to them now, because I wouldn't want to see Explorer Threats come out with the same approaches again, at least without having received your comment letters and being able to consider those concerns now. So I know it's difficult. So I'm talking about individual organizations as a member of rights to comment.
You're talking about comment letters other than comment letters from CNAC.
Yes, I'm talking about your individuals or your organizations, if you can consider it. I know it's hard.
Okay.
but that tickets are going to be enough.
And you don't have to comment on the entire conceptual framework. Any little piece that you think you have insights into or are concerned about where we're going or really like where we're going.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be a formal letter. You can send off an email to the staff.
I would like something we could put on our website, to be honest. Or if you don't want it, at least we have something from you written down so we can see it from an objective point of view. But
yeah, and also if you'd like any further background on any of it, or if you'd like to discuss any of it further, we'd be happy to do that as well.
Very much. Okay.